వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సమప్రభా నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా శివశక్త్యాయుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం నచే దేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి అత స్వామారాధ్యా హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
శ్రీ సాయిరాం. అట్ ది అవుట్సెట్ మై మోస్ట్ లవింగ్ అండ్ ప్రేయర్ఫుల్ సల్యూటేషన్స్ అట్ ద డివైన్ లోటస్ ఫీట్ ఆఫ్ అవర్ మోస్ట్ బిలవడ్ భగవాన్ శ్రీ సత్యసాయి బాబా. డియర్ లిస్నర్, యు ఆర్ ట్యూన్ టు రేడియో సాయి గ్లోబల్ హార్మనీ ఆన్ ఏషియా స్ట్రీమ్, బ్రింగింగ్ యూ 24 అవర్స్ అ డే, 7 డేస్ అ వీక్ ద లవ్ అండ్ ద మెసేజ్ ఆఫ్ భగవాన్ శ్రీ సత్యసాయి బాబా. Good morning, greetings and loving Sai Ram on this Thursday on the 11th of June 2020. And with me, Team Radio Sai Sunil, welcoming you to this morning segment, Divine Glory, on Thursday live from Prashanthinilaya. Let me, as always, read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. When we think of scriptures, we are often frightened by the rules and regulations they impose on us. Is that the correct approach? What do scriptures really tell us? Bhagwan reveals to us today, and I quote, You are the dearly loved children of the Lord. You are as pure and as sacred as air. Don't condemn yourself as sinners. You are lion cubs, not sheep. You have taken birth as inheritors of eternal bliss. You are wavelets of immortality, not bodies compounded from matter. Material objects are here to serve you at your bidding, not the other way around. Don't think that scriptures or Vedas lay down a bundle of frightening rules, regulations and laws. Every rule is given to you by the Lord as lawgiver. All elements in the cosmos, every particle everywhere, are acting every moment as ordered by Him. Remember, no worship can be higher and more beneficial than serving such a Lord. One has to offer love to Him, more love than one bears to anything else in the world and anything else in this world and the next. He must be loved as the one and only. Remember Him adoringly, with such love always. Unquote. This was taken from Vidya Vahini, chapter 13. Dear listener, today, as the world is continuing with lockdowns and social distancing norms due to the spread of the coronavirus disease, let us all continue to take all the precautions mandated by the government and the health department, like social distancing, self-quarantining, also maintain personal and community hygiene. Also, let us continue our prayers at our own places for world peace. Talking about prayers, let me now play for you a mantra. The efficacy of this mantra is in destroying all the harmful germs and viruses. And this mantra is, or this verse is from the Krishna Yajurveda Taittiriya Aranyaka. Let me now play for you.
Om Atrinatva Krime Hanmi Kanvena Jamadagnina Vishvavaso Brahmana Hataha Krimina Gumraja Apyesha Vistapatir Hataha Atho Mata Atho Pita Atho Sthura Atho Kshudra Atho Krishna Atho Shveta Atho Ashatika Hata Shveta Bhissaha Sarve Hata Ahara Vadya Shrutasya Havisho Yata Tat Satyam Yadamuyamasya Jambhayo Adadhami Tadahitat Khantan Rasi Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
This mantra that you just heard is chanted daily in the morning and evening during the Mandir prayer sessions here at Prashanthi Nilayam. And for those of you who don't know, let me also tell that these prayer sessions are streamed live for all to listen on Radio Sai's Prashanthi Mandir Live YouTube channel, Sri Satya Sai Baba Facebook page, and of course Radio Sai's Asia stream and Telugu stream, both at 8 a.m. in the morning and in the evening at 5 p.m. So you could log on at these times. The time right now in our studios is 51 minutes past 9 a.m. That is Indian Standard Time. And today in Divine Glory, I have lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book, Sri Sai Satcharitra, written by Sri Hemant Pant, followed by an interview from our archives with Dr. Valuvan Jeevanandam. In conversation with Dr. Valuvan Jeevanandam is Professor Jeevankatraman, the former Vice Chancellor of the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning and also the former Director of Radio Sai. But first, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemant Pant. We are thankful to Vasanthi Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a happy, holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. Also praying to Lord Almighty that the pandemic caused by the coronavirus disease be eradicated and all the suffering come to an end at the earliest. Samasta lokaha sukino bhavantu.
There are other schools where you see an altogether different spectacle. The disciples go there to seek knowledge and spend the money, time and labor, but ultimately they don't gain much. The guru there boasts of his secret knowledge and his straightforwardness. He makes a show of his sacredness and holiness. He speaks a lot and sings his own glory, but his own words do not touch the disciples' heart, and they are not convinced. So far as self-realization is concerned, he has not reached that. How can such schools be of any use to the disciples, and how can they be benefited? The guru mentioned above was of different type. By his grace, realization flashed upon me of itself, without effort or study. I had nothing to seek. Everything became clear to me as broad daylight. The Guru alone knows how the inverse suspension with head down and feet up can give happiness. Among the four, one was a Karmatha, who knew how to observe and abstain from certain rites. The second was Dhyani, who was puffed up with pride of knowledge. And the third was a Bhakta, who surrendered himself completely to God, believing that he was the sole doer. When they were discussing and arguing, the question of God came up, and they, depending on their unaided knowledge, went in search of him. Sai, who was discrimination and dispassion incarnate, was one of the four. On being himself Brahma incarnate, some may ask, why did he get mixed with them and act foolishly? He did that for setting an example to follow. Though an incarnation himself, he respected a low banjari by accepting his food with the firm belief that food is Brahma, and showed how those who rejected Banjari's hospitable offer suffered, and how it was impossible to get dhyan without a guru. The Shruti in the Taittiriya Upanishad exhorts us to honor and worship mother, father and preceptor, and to study the sacred scriptures. These are the means of purifying our minds, and unless this purification is effected, self-realization is not possible. Neither the senses nor the mind and intellect reach the self. Modes of proof such as perception and inference will not help us in the matter. It is the grace of the Guru that counts. The objects of our light such as Dharma, Artha and Kama are attainable with our effort. But the fourth object, Moksha or liberation, can only be had with the help of the Guru. In the life story of Sri Sai, many personalities appear and play their part. Astrologers come and give out their predictions, princes, noblemen, ordinary and poor men, sannyasis, yogis, singers and others come for darshan. Even a Mahar comes and, making his salutation, says, Sai is a Mahabab who will do away with our rounds of births and deaths. So many others, such as jugglers, gondalis, the blind and the lame, natpantis, dancers and other players, come and are given suitable reception. The Vanjari also appeared at the right time and played the part assigned to him. Let us now revert to the other story. Fasting and Mrs. Gokhale. Baba never fasted himself, nor did he allow others to do so. The mind of the person who fasts is never at ease. Then how could he attain his paramartha, goal of life? God is not attained on an empty stomach. First, the soul has to be appeased. If there be no food in the stomach and nutrition, with what eyes should we see God? With what tongue should we describe His greatness? And with what ears should we hear the same? In short, when all our organs get the proper nutrition and are sound, we can practice devotion and other sadhanas to attain God. Therefore, neither fasting nor overeating is good. Moderation in diet is really wholesome, both to the body and the mind. One Mrs. Gokhale came to Shirdi with an introductory letter from Mrs. Kashibai Kanitkar, a devotee of Baba, to Dada Kelkar. She came to Baba with a determination to sit at Baba's feet and observe a 3-day fast. The previous day, Baba said to Dada Kelkar that he would not allow his children to starve during the Shimga or the holy holidays, and that if they had to starve, why was he there? Next day, when the woman went with Dada Kelkar and sat at Baba's feet, Baba at once said to her, "Where is the necessity of fasting? Go to Dada Bhai's house, prepare the dish of Puran Polis with wheat rotis and gram flour and jaggery, feed his children and yourself too." Shimga holidays were on. Mrs. Kelkar was then going through her periods and there was nobody to cook in Dada Bhai's house. So Baba's advice was very timely. Then Mrs. Gokhale had to go to Dada Bhai's house and prepare the dish as directed. She cooked that day, fed others and herself. What a good story and how beautiful its import. Baba's Sarkar. Baba gave a story of his boyhood as follows. When I was a youngster, I was in search of bread and went to Bid. There, I got embroidery work. I worked hard, sparing no pains. The employer was very much pleased with me. 3 other boys worked before me. The first got 50 rupees, the second 100 rupees, and the third 150 rupees. And I was given twice the total of this amount, that is 600 rupees. After seeing my cleverness, the employer loved me, praised me and honored me with a full dress, a turban for the head and a shela for the body. I kept this dress intact without using it. I thought, what a man might give does not last long and is always imperfect. But what my Sarkar or God gives lasts to the end of time. No other gift from any man can be compared to his. My Sarkar says, take, take. But everybody comes to me and says, give, give. Nobody attends carefully to the meaning of what I say. My Sarkar's treasury is full. It's overflowing, I say. Dig out and take away this wealth in cartloads. The blessed son of a true mother should fill himself with this wealth. The skill of my fakir, the leela of my lord, and the aptitude of my Sarkar is quite unique. What about me? Body will mix with earth, breath with air. This time won't come again. No matter where I go or where I sit, Maya always troubles me much. Still, I'm always anxious for my men. He who does anything, spiritual endeavor, will reap its fruit. And he who remembers these words of mine will get invaluable happiness. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 33. Greatness of Udi. Scorpion sting and plague cases cured. Jamnir miracle. Narayan Rao sickness. Balabhuva Sutar. Appa Saheb Kulkarni. Hari Bhav Karnik. In the last chapter we described the greatness of the Guru. Now in this we will describe the greatness of the Udi. However, both are interlinked. The greatness of Udi is due to the spiritual grandeur of Baba. Preliminary. Let us now bow before the great saints. Their merciful glances will destroy mountains of sins and do away with all the blemishes of our character. Their talk gives us good teachings and confers on us invaluable happiness. Their minds do not know any difference, such as this is ours and that is yours. Such differentiation never arises in their minds. Their debts, obligations will never be repaid by us in this birth as well as in many future births. Udi. It is well known that Baba took Dakshina from all, and out of the amount thus collected he spent on charity and purchased fuel. This fuel he put in the Dhuni, the sacred fire, which he kept ever burning. The ash from this fire was called Udi, and it was freely distributed to the devotees at the time of the departure from Shirdi. What did Baba teach by this Udi? Baba taught by this Udi that all the visible phenomena in the universe are as transient as the ash. Our bodies composed of matter of the five elements will fall down after all the enjoyments are over and reduced to ashes. In order to remind the devotees of the fact that their bodies will be reduced to ashes, Baba distributed Udi to them. Baba also taught by the Udi that the Brahma is the only reality and the universe is ephemeral, and that no one in this world, be he a son, father or wife, is really ours. We come here in this world alone, and we have to go from here alone. It has been found that the Udi cured many physical and mental maladies, but Baba wanted to repeat into the devotee's ears the principles of discrimination between the unreal and the real. He taught non-attachment for the unreal by his Udi and Dakshina. The Udi taught us discrimination and Dakshina taught us non-attachment. Unless we have these two things, it is not possible for us to cross over the sea of the mundane existence. So Baba asked for Dakshina. And while the devotees took leave, he gave Udi as prasad, smeared some of it on their foreheads and placed his boon conferring hand on them. When Baba was in a cheerful mood, he used to sing merrily. One such song was about Udi. The meaning of the song was, O playful Ram, come, come and bring with you sacks of udi. Baba used to sing in very clear and tender tones. So besides the spiritual implication of udi, it had also its material significance. It conferred health, prosperity, freedom from anxiety, and many other worldly gains. So the udi has helped us gain both our ends, material as well as spiritual. We shall now begin with the stories about the udi. Scorpion sting. Narayan Motiram Jani of Nasik was a devotee of Baba. He was serving under another devotee of Baba by name Ramchandra Vaman Modak. Once he went to Shirdi with his mother and saw Baba. Then Baba himself told her that her son should start independent business. Some days after this prophecy turned true, Narayan Jani left service and started a boarding house, Anand Ashram, which thrived well. Once a friend of this Narayan Rao was stung by a scorpion, and the pain caused by it was severe and unbearable. Udi is most efficacious in such cases. It is to be applied on the point of pain, and so Narayan Rao searched for it but found none. Then he stood before Baba's picture and invoked Baba's aid, chanted Baba's name, and taking out a pinch of the ashes of the joss stick burning in front of Baba's picture and thinking it as Baba's udi, applied it on the seat of pain and the sting. As soon as he moved his fingers, the pain vanished and both the persons were moved and felt delighted. Bubonic plague case. Once a devotee in Bandra came to know that his daughter, who was staying in another place, was down with bubonic plague. He had no udi with him, so he sent word to Nana Saheb Chandorkar to send the same. Nana Saheb got this message en route Thana railway station when he was travelling with his wife to Kalyan. He had no udi with him then. He therefore took up some dust from the road, meditated upon Sai Baba, invoked his aid, and applied it to his wife's forehead. The devotee was very glad to learn that his daughter, who was suffering for 3 days, began to improve from the very moment Nana Saheb invoked Baba's aid near the Thana railway station. The Jamnir miracle. In the year 1904-05, Nana Saheb Chandorkar was Mamlatdar at Jamnir in the Khandesh district, which is more than 100 miles from Shirdi. His daughter Mainatai was pregnant and was due to deliver. Her case was very serious and she was suffering from labor pains for the last 2 or 3 days. Nana Saheb tried all remedies but in vain. He then remembered Baba and invoked his aid. There in Shirdi, one Ramgir Bua, whom Baba called Bapugir Bua, was leaving for his native place in Khandesh. Baba called him and told him to stop at Jamnir on his way home and give the udi and arati to Nana Saheb. Ramgir Bua said he had only 2 rupees with him and this amount was barely sufficient for the railway fare up to Jalgaon, and it was not possible for him to go from Jalgaon to Jamnir, a distance of about 30 miles. Baba assured him that he need not care as everything would be provided for. Then Baba asked Shama to write a well-known arati composed by Madhav Adkar and gave a copy of it with udi to Ramgir Bua to be delivered to Nana Saheb. Then relying on Baba's words, Ramgir Bua left Shirdi and reached Jalgaon at about 2:45 a.m. He had only 2 annas left with him and he was in a plight. To his great relief, he heard somebody calling out, "Who is Bapugir Bua of Shirdi?" He went to him and told him that he was Bapugir Bua. Then the person, professing to be sent by Nana Saheb, took him to an excellent tonga with a good pair of horses. They both drove in it. The tonga ran fast and early in the morning they came to a brooklet. The man took the horses for watering them and he asked Ramgir Bua to partake of some eatables. On seeing that person's beard, moustache and livery, Ramgir Bua suspected him to be a Muslim and was unwilling to take any refreshments from him. But the man satisfied Ramgir Bua saying that he was a Hindu, a Kshatriya of Garhwal, and that Nana Sahib has sent these refreshments and there should be no difficulty in its acceptance. Then both of them took the refreshments and started again. They reached Jamner at dawn. Ramgir Bua alighted to attend a call of nature and returned within a few minutes but found there was no Tonga and no driver. He was dumbfounded. Then he went to the neighboring Kacheri and on making inquiries learned that the Mamlatdar was at home. He went to Nana Sahib's house and gave Nana Sahib Baba's Udi and Aarti. At this time, Mainatai's case was in the most serious condition and all were in deep anxiety about her. Nana Sahib called out his wife and asked her to give the Udi mixed with water to their daughter to drink. He thought that Baba's help was most opportune. In a few minutes came the news that the delivery was safe and that the crisis had passed away. When Ramgir Bua thanked Nana Sahib for the pune, tonga and the refreshments, Nana Sahib was greatly surprised, as he had sent none to the station and was not aware of any person coming from Shirdi. Mr. B.V. Dev of Thana, retired Mamlatdar, made inquiries about this matter with Bapu Rao Chandurkar, son of Nana Sahib, and Ramgir Bua of Shirdi, and after satisfying himself, wrote an elaborate article, part prose and part poetry, in the Sri Sai Leela magazine, volume 13, number 11, 12 and 13. B.V. Narasimha Swami has also taken down the statements of Mainatai and Bapu Sahib Chandurkar and Ramgir Bua, dated 1st June 1936, 16th September 1936 and 1st December 1936 respectively, and published them in his Devotee's Experiences Part 3. The following is quoted from Ramgir Bua's statement. One day, Baba called me to him and gave me a packet of Udi and a copy of Baba's Arati. I had to go to Khandesh at the time. Baba directed me to go to Jamnir and told me to deliver the Arati and Udi to Nana Sahib Chandurkar at Jamnir. I said to Baba that all I had was 2 rupees and asked him how that could take me by train from Kopargaon to Jalgaon and next from Jalgaon to Jamnir. Baba said, God will give. That was a Friday and I started at once. I reached Manmad at 7:30 p.m. and Jalgaon at 2:45 a.m. At that time, plague regulations were enforced and I had much trouble. I was to discover what I should do to get to Jamnir. At about 3 a.m., a peon in boots, turban and equipped with other details of good dress came to me and took me to a tonga and drove me on. On the way at Bhaghur, I took refreshments. We reached Jamnir early in the morning and by the time I attended my call of nature, the tonga and its driver had disappeared.
Narayan Rao.
Bhakt Narayan Rao had the good fortune to see Baba twice during the latter's lifetime. 3 years after the passing away of Baba in 1918, he wanted to come to Shirdi but could not. Within a year of Baba's Mahasamadhi, he fell sick and suffered much. All possible remedies gave him no relief. So he meditated on Baba day and night. One night, he had a vision. Baba came through a cellar, comforted him, saying, "Don't be anxious. You will be improving from tomorrow, and within a week, you will be on your legs." Narayan Rao got perfectly well within the time indicated in the vision. Now the point for consideration is this. Was Baba living because he had the body, or was he dead because he left it? No. Baba is ever alive, for he transcends both life and death. He who loved him wholeheartedly gets response from him at any time and at any place. He is always by our side and will take any form, appear before the devout Bhakta and satisfy him.
Appa Sahib Kulkarni.
In 1917, Appa Sahib Kulkarni was transferred to Thana and began to worship Baba's picture presented to him by Bala Sahib Bhatte. In real earnest, he did the worship. He offered flowers, sandal paste and naivedya daily to Baba in the picture and longed intently to see him. In this connection, it may be remarked that seeing Baba's picture earnestly is equal to seeing him in person. The following story illustrates this statement. Bala Bua Sutar. A saint of Mumbai named Balabhu Vasutar, who on account of his piety, devotion and style was called modern Tukaram. He came to Shirdi for the first time in 1917. When he bowed before Baba, the latter said, "I know this man since 4 years. Balabhu wondered and thought, how could that be, as that was his first trip to Shirdi? But thinking about it seriously, he recollected that he had prostrated himself 4 years ago before Baba's portrait at Mumbai. He was convinced about the significance of Baba's words. He said to himself, how omniscient and all-pervading are the saints, and how kind are they to the devotees. I merely bowed to his photo, but this fact was noticed by Baba, and in due time, he made me realize that seeing his photo is equivalent to seeing him in person." Now, we return to Appa Saheb's story. While he was in Thana, he had to go on tour to Bhiwandi and was expected to return after a week. In his absence, the following wonderful thing took place on the third day. At noon, a fakir turned up at Appa Saheb's house. His features resembled exactly those of Baba's photo. Mrs. Kulkarni and the children all asked him whether he was Sai Baba of Shirdi. He said no, but that he was an obedient servant of his and came there at his order to inquire after the well-being of the family. Then he asked for Dakshina. The lady gave him a rupee. He gave her a small packet of udi and asked her to keep this in the shrine. Then he left the house and went away. Now hear the wonderful leela of Sai. Appa Saheb could not proceed with his tour as his horse fell sick at Bhiwandi. He returned home that afternoon and learned from his wife about the fakir's visit. He got very restless as he did not have the darshan of the fakir. Moreover, he did not like that only 1 rupee was paid to him as dakshina. He said that had he been present, he would have paid not less than 10 rupees. Then he immediately started in quest of the fakir and searched for him in the masjid and other places without taking any food. His search was in vain. He then returned home and took his food. The readers may remember that Baba's dictum in chapter 32, God's quest should not be made on an empty belly. After his meals, he went out for a walk with a friend, Mr. Chitri. After going some distance, they saw a man approaching them rapidly. Appa Saheb thought he must be the fakir that came to his house at noon, as his features tallied with those of Baba in the photo. The fakir immediately put forth his hand and asked for dakshina. Appa Saheb gave him a rupee. He demanded again and again, and so Appa Saheb gave him 2 more. Still, he was not satisfied. Then he borrowed 3 rupees from Mr. Chitre and gave them to him. He wanted still more. Appa Saheb asked him to accompany him to his home. Then they all returned home and Appa Saheb gave him 3 rupees, in all 9. He looked unsatisfied and demanded again. Then Appa Saheb told him that he had a currency note of 10 rupees. The fakir asked for the same, took it and returned the 9 rupees and went away. Appa Saheb had earlier said that he would pay 10 rupees, and that sum was taken from him, and 9 rupees, consecrated by Baba's touch, were returned to him. The figure 9 is significant. It denotes the 9 types of devotion. It may also be noted here that Baba gave 9 coins to one Lakshmibai Shinde at his last moment. Appa Saheb examined the udi packet and found that it contained some flower leaves and akshata. Then some time afterwards, he got a hair from Baba when he saw him at Shirdi. He put the udi packet and the hair in a taviz and wore it always on his arm. Appa Saheb realized the power of the udi. Though he was very efficient, he got 40 rupees as pay in the beginning, but after he secured Baba's photo and his udi, he got many times more and also got much power and influence. And along with these temporal benefits, his spiritual progress was also rapid. So those who are fortunate enough to get Baba's udi should, after bath, apply it on the forehead and take some of it mixed with water as holy teerth. Haribhav Karnik. In 1917, Haribao Karnik of the Hanu in Thana district came to Shirdi on the Guru Purnima day in the month of Ashad and worshipped Baba with all the formalities. He offered clothes in Dakshina and after taking Baba's leave, got down the steps of the masjid. Then he thought he should offer one more rupee to Baba and was just turning to climb again when Shama signaled him by gesture that as he had got Baba's leave, he should go and not return. So he started for home. On his way, when he went into the temple of Kala Ram at Nasik for darshan, the Saint Narsik Maharaj, who used to sit inside the temple, came to Haribhav, caught him by the wrist and said, "Give me my 1 rupee." Karnik was surprised. He paid the rupee most willingly and thought Sai Baba recovered the rupee which he intended in his mind to give through Saint Narsingh Maharaj. This story illustrates a fact that all saints are one and illustrates how they work in unison. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Shri Guru Sai Baba.
Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Satguru Shirdi Baba.
Mangala Giridhar Sai Baba,
Mangala Giridhar Sai Baba,
Shri Guru Purna Sai Baba,
Shri Guru Purna Sai Baba,
Karuna Sagar Sai Baba,
Karuna Sagar Sai Baba,
Nitya Niranjana Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Shri Guru Sai Baba.
Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Satguru Shirdi Baba.
Oh. Sai Ram Doctor, it's a pleasure to have you with us in the studios of Radio Sai. I might tell you that you are no stranger to our listeners out there, for the simple reason, actually there are two reasons, two good reasons. One is we took the liberty of broadcasting extracts from your wonderful article in the book Inspired Medicine, published by Leela Press. And after we did that, one day I was knocked out to know that one of the persons on whom you did the heart transplants was right here. And he was sitting there in the very chair you are now sitting, and he told us all about how you fixed him when he was almost beyond repair, shall I say. So we are just absolutely thrilled to have you here. And Ravi Mariwala used to tell me, why don't you invite Dr. Jeevanandam? I used to tell him, bring him. I'm all waiting for him. I'll just give him enough time to get over the jet lag. I hope you got over the jet lag by now. And so we welcome you most warmly and heartily to our studios. And why don't you begin by telling our listeners and also myself a little bit about yourself, after which we will talk about how you came to Swami. Over to you, sir, doctor.
Sure. It's my pleasure to be here. I had... you'd like to know where I grew up or...
not only me, all our listeners out there. There are thousands of them from Kuwait to Philippines and Japan. They're all eager to know about you.
I came with my parents to the U.S. in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
We settled in a suburb of New York called the Fort Lee.
You must have been about 10 years or something like
that. Yeah, I was 10 years old. So then grew up basically in that area. Attended Columbia University for college and then went to medical school at Columbia. And then I did my surgical training in New York City at Columbia as well. And then I did my cardiac training. So it was about 1991 where I moved out of Columbia and went to Philadelphia. And I worked in a place called Temple University there in Philadelphia from 1992, really, to 1998. And then with Swami's grace, he got me a position to go to Chicago, and I went there in 1998, and there I am currently.
Good. Now you mentioned with Swami's grace, obviously we would like to know from you directly how Swami entered your life.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting story because if you told
that's
me when
exactly I, what we want to hear.
If you told me when I was growing up that I would know about Swami and I would be devoted to Swami, I would have thought everybody was crazy. Because
by the way, a lot of people whom you would see around here are of that type. In fact, a good number of them, I hate to disclose the percentage, did not believe in Swami. And they thought it was all a hoax, but they were the fellows to be bowled out first.
So when I grew up in a typical materialistic, immature way. My whole life was focused on attaining worldly goods, such as, you know, expensive cars, race cars, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was very spiritual, and she used to tell us... to pray and then to do, slokas. And, of course, every single time she used to say that, I used to try every single excuse not to do that.
By the way, when you say typical American, perhaps you meant typical modern American, because the very first founding fathers of America were the pilgrims,
mm-hmm.
who were very religious.
They were, I guess when I say a typical American, maybe I'm
modern.
Not modern American. Maybe I'm not being fair, because there are a lot of Americans who are still very religious, and you know. But let's put a typical modern person, you know, more
that's
involved
more like,
with
because that type is found everywhere. That species is universal. Carry on, please.
So I grew up that way. My mother, of course, believed in God, and you know, I guess I kind of believed in God, but not really with any type of devotion. And, you know, a very interesting story, because I think in 1985 or so, my aunt, who lives in Tuticorin,
mm-hmm.
We went and visited her, and she said, let's all go to Kodaikanal, because there's a person there in Kodaikanal who, if you give him, you can ask him questions and he'll give you answers. And, you know, we call him Sai Baba. And my first response was, oh, no, not another one of my aunt's little, gimmickry type of people. And, of course, I didn't want to go. But, you know, look at the opportunity, because at that time, I'm sure there weren't that many people there in Kodaikanal. You could have had a real close encounter with Swami.
Absolutely.
So that's why, you know, Swami says you can only go and meet Swami when it's time.
That's true.
And that was not the time. So how I actually got to know about Swami is my parents were in New York till 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And then they moved to Phoenix, Arizona. And in their getting acquaintances in Phoenix, they met somebody who had a Sai Baba center.
Mm.
And so they went to Sai Baba centers. That center, it's in Mesa, Arizona. It's close to where they live in Scottsdale. And so every single time I used to go to Phoenix, they used to say, come on, you have to go to Bhajans. So they had Sunday Bhajans. And in the beginning, my first response was, oh, no, this is another one of my mom's little, games trying to get me into being devoted to God. And, we used to do everything possible to avoid that. So if I had to have a plane ticket, you know, you take it on Sunday just before Bhajans, so you didn't have to go to Bhajans and, you know, the usual naughty things that a son would do, I guess. Of course, Mom had all these books about Swami at that point. And, you know, she'd read about the books and she knew about Swami. And she'd want me to read the books. So every single time I used to go back home to New Jersey, she'd give me all these books and said, did you read it? And, of course, I had a big stack of books at home that I hadn't quite read, but found every excuse in the world why not to read them.
You plead the Fifth Amendment or anything like that?
No, I think I conveniently told a lie. And then, you know, slowly, but my mom was very, very persistent, and she found a Sai center in New Jersey that, she kind of made us go to. And slowly I started enjoying the bhajan music, and that's actually what was the first thing that really drew me to the Sai family, is the music. And slowly I started even listening to that music in the car. And then, one amazing story, when I really became a Sai Baba devotee was I was going on a plane, and I was going to Phoenix, and I know I put two or three novels that had something to read on the plane. And I boarded the plane, tried to pick out one of the novels, and, you know, there were no novels there. The only book that was there was The Vision of Sai by Rita Bruce. And I know I didn't put that book there because there's no way that would be the one book I would use to be on the travels. But I started reading it. And, for some reason, I just didn't even close the book. And the next thing I know, it was 4 hours away, and we had landed in Arizona and finished about three-quarters of the book. And for some reason, I think that was the time Swami thought it was time to reel me in. And, I was completely hooked on Swami at that point. And, you know, I was somebody who would love to eat, a good meal. I was a non-vegetarian. And I stepped off the plane a vegetarian. And, you know, my mom had cooked all this food, and I said, Mom, I'm a vegetarian now. And, you know, she, of course, you know, started laughing because, you know, it started with one of my little jokes or something. And that was interesting because that was 1992. It was late 1992, and since then I have not eaten any meat.
So one book and one plane ride made you into a vegetarian.
Vegetarian and a Swami devotee.
Okay.
That was a miraculous plane ride.
So the airline should advertise that flight. Make a lot of money. A lot of people may want to get on that flight. Okay.
So that was actually my journey towards Swami. And it was interesting because that was the time that I'd become a attending physician. And, it's very interesting because, in the U.S., when you become an attending, that's when you actually start making, you know, a good amount of money and things. And it was interesting because Swami kind of waited till that time. You know, when you're a resident, you don't have that much money. You're just kind of going from paycheck to paycheck. And then when you have a little bit more money, I think Swami at that time said, okay, this is time when, you know, we bring his values in so he doesn't go completely overboard.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, from then on, we used to go to Phoenix on the purpose of going to Bhajans. So instead of taking a plane light out on Sunday, we should take planes out on Monday so we would be able to go to Bhajans and go to our study sessions.
You would go all the way from Philadelphia to Arizona?
Well, more often than before. I mean, we used to go maybe once or twice a year, and then we started going three or four times a year.
Okay.
And then we started attending our bhajan sessions in New Jersey itself more often.
Mm-hmm.
And, at that time we were in Philadelphia, and, we were trying to find a Sai center in Philadelphia. And, you know, as we say, you know, Swami determines when it's time, because we had searched high and low and we really couldn't find a good center, and we're kind of a little bit upset. Then all of a sudden one day, you know, a person calls us up and they said, oh, you know, there's a great center. And we said, oh boy, how far is it? And you know what? It was 5 minutes away. Very, very close by. And it was one of the best, you know, experiences we had, because that center really was a very small center, but we were very, very close. And we ended up becoming all family, you know, just from the people going to that center.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were there, and one day somebody came from India and they had a guest lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And he came there and he was talking about the new super specialty hospital.
Mm.
And
was he a doctor?
I don't remember exactly who it was, but
he knew
about
the hospital.
And I think he was a physician, because he was there. And then after the guest lecture, you know, Malati Nayak, who's the head of that center, introduced us. And he said, oh, you're a cardiac surgeon? And I said, yes. And he said, you know, we're doing cardiac surgery there. And, you know, we're looking for equipment, some of the equipment that we couldn't get in India. And I said, what specifically are you looking for? And he said, we're looking for heart valves, because, as you know, heart valvular disease is very endemic in India. And, you know, there's a lot of rheumatic disease. And he said, you know, is there any mechanism by which we can set up some arrangement to get valves? Because they were in short supply in India. And I said, you know, we could work on it. I didn't have any real idea on how we were going to do it. But I said, you know, we can surely work on it. And, you know, he said, oh, you should come and see the hospital. And I said, boy, you know, if Swami wills it, you know, it will happen.
Hmm.
So that was around January, and
January of which year?
I think it was 2003. Oh, sorry.
1993.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay, 10 years ago.
About 10 years ago. So I started making some inquiries about how we could, you know, come and help. And, you know, obviously, you know, nothing happened, so Swami wills it. And for the longest time, nothing was going on. And, you know, I was thinking about coming to India for a visit. But at that point, we had some turnover in our section of cardiac surgery. And I was the only person able to do transplants. And we were a big, busy transplant center. So, you know, even my wife, Sheila, said, you know, can we go to India this year? And I said, well, you're going to have to go on your own, because I don't think I will have time off. And so she said, just ask your boss if you can take some time off. I said, I can't even ask him, because, you know, I'm the only one doing transplants. If I go, he won't do transplants. So, you know, this is, again, you know, one of Swami's thing, miracles. We end up hiring a new faculty member that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was brand new, so he didn't know much. And so my boss comes to me and he goes, listen, you know, you've been working very, very hard. I think you really need to take some time off. So why don't you cover for your partner when he goes to Japan? And then when he comes back, why don't you take about 2 or 3 weeks off and kind of just relax and enjoy yourself? So, you know, from completely out of the blue, because I didn't even have to ask for time off. He basically came and volunteered time off for me. So, you know, again, one of the ways Swami works. And then after that, you know, my wife said, well, you know, if you're going to come to India, how about visiting, you know, Puttaparthi? And I said, fine. And, she said, did you work on any of the valves and everything that they had asked you for? And I said, you know, just very, very superficially, but really hadn't made any inquiries. And, you know, you wouldn't believe it, because the week after that, a lot of the salesmen came to me. And they said, oh, we hear you're from India and you might be going back to India. Do you have any interest in taking any of these products back for charity work? So even before I asked, they came to me. And we got a big bounty full of medical products. And we left India, and I came in search of coming to the hospital. And Swami was in Whitefield at that point. And that was the first time that we got to see Swami. I was all the way in the back of the line, and I just remember a very small yellow, orange speck, because we were so far back. But it was a very, very fantastic experience at that point. And then I took a taxi and came over to Puttaparthi, and I came to the hospital.
Nobody knew you were coming?
Nobody knew.
And that's why you were at the back. Okay.
So I came here, and then at that point, the head of the blood bank was the first person I met.
Mm-hmm.
And so he welcomed me, and then we spoke, and then he introduced me to everybody else,
mm-hmm.
and they introduced me to some of the surgeons who were there at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, they asked what I did. I said transplants. So they wanted a little talk on transplants. I just happened to have some slides, so I gave them a talk on transplants.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave them a lot of the products that we had. And then, they said, you need to come back at some point. And I said, when Swami wills. And that was the first time I actually had come to the hospital. And we went back, and then, we had darshan again from a long distance from Swami. But it was a very nice experience, and that was the first real experience with Swami. And then they had the
This was in Vrindavan.
This was in Vrindavan, yes.
Had they built the Sairamesh shed at that time, or not yet?
They hadn't expanded. I remember sitting there, it was in the sun.
Was there a tree and all that?
Yeah, there was a tree, and you had to sit there, and then sat on the sand and the concrete.
Yes, there was a big circular shed, and you used to sit under it. That was called the Sairam shed.
Okay.
Okay, so you came at that time. That's very nice.
So then the next thing that actually happened and by that time we had become slowly more and more understanding about Swami's values, and the kids were going to SSE classes. We were going to regular bhajans at that point. And then the next event that happened was I got invited to come to the cardiac symposia that Swami had.
Yes, there were a couple of them.
So this wasn't the first one. I got invited to the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And, interesting, I was trying to figure out how they would even know me. And I guess that my visit to Puttaparthi earlier, and I talked about transplants, and they wanted to come and somebody give a talk on transplant. So that's why they had invited me. So I guess, as we say, every single little event has some significance.
Of course.
They're all interweaved together.
Yes.
It's Swami's little, plays, little games.
It keeps happening all the time.
So I ended up coming to the second symposium. And, that was a fantastic experience because, only Swami can get all these eminent physicians. There were so many people who were real masters in the field of surgery. I was just in awe.
Right? And you had to come all the way to Puttaparthi to see the
masters. Exactly.
Imagine that.
These are people that I would have absolutely no access to if I was in the United
Talking
States.
Talking of transplant, I must just interrupt to tell you that way back in 1968, I was in America. I was at the University of Michigan spending a couple of years as a postdoctoral fellow. And guess who came there? Christian Barnard. And
uh-huh.
There was a big auditorium, university auditorium, and he gave a public lecture, and the place was packed. I was
one
of them. I mean, he was the only guy who had done transplant at that time. Carry on.
Oh, yeah, that was the heyday.
Heyday.
And so, people like Donald Ross, and I mean, those were really masters in the field. And they had all come to see Swami. I mean, they were invited to the symposium here. And I came here and I'm looking at all these people and say, boy, it's amazing that they would come all the way from, either Australia or England, United States to come. And at that point, I had talked to the people, and they wanted me to come and work at the hospital. So we had made some plans to do so. And
how many times have you come to this hospital since then?
I've probably come about 10 times.
10 times.
10 times. I try to come every year. There are a couple of years that I've skipped, and a couple of years I've come more than once.
And every time you stay about 10 days, 12 days or
about,
so.
Yes.
And you do quite a few surgeries during that period.
In the beginning times, I used to actually come and do the surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as things have evolved, because now there are surgeons here who've been here for a long period of time, mm-hmm. We basically come and give them support at the, mm-hmm. When they do difficult cases or if there are new techniques that we pick up.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, things like off-pump coronary bypass
surgery. Yes, we've been hearing about it then.
So
why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because that seems to be new and everybody
sure.
does not know what it's all about.
In the past, when we did bypass surgery, so bypass surgery means that the blood vessels through the heart have a blockage.
Mm-hmm.
And when they have a blockage, you actually take a vein from the leg or mm-hmm. an artery from the arm or an artery from the chest, and you basically go around the blockage. So it's a detour.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we call it bypass grafting.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, we thought that the heart had to be stopped
mm-hmm.
to get that done because obviously the heart is beating. Mm-hmm. And when it's beating, it's very, very hard to do the surgery on a mm-hmm. beating heart. So we used to go on what's called the heart-lung machine. The heart-lung machine basically takes the function of the heart and lung so you can stop the heart. And when the heart is stopped, there's no blood flow in the blood vessels, so you can see the blood vessels and you can do the connection is called an anastomosis. Mm-hmm. So we actually use a very, very fine suture about the width of your hair and we do the anastomosis. Probably about, in about 1997, there are some physicians who started doing those connections or anastomoses on a beating heart as mm-hmm. opposed to really stopping the heart. And the techniques have evolved since then, and we now have a lot of apparatus and a lot of equipment to help us stabilize the blood vessels. And for instance, what these stabilizers do is they apply a little bit of suction on the heart, mm-hmm. and you can actually lift that portion of the heart, so the rest of the heart beats while that portion of the blood vessel is stable and it doesn't move as much. Now, granted, it's not as easy as doing it with the heart that's completely still, because, you know, that, you know, when everything is completely still,
what's
it's easy
to do. What's the special advantage of doing beating heart surgery as opposed to using a heart-lung?
Well, you know, the heart-lung machine is a lifesaver, and it's a very, very important machine to have. But I think there are some disadvantages for it. For instance, it requires a fair amount of blood. Mm-hmm. If you have some, it could cause bleeding. Mm-hmm. There's an incidence of what we call, we affectionately call pump head. Mm-hmm. You know, when patients go on the heart-lung machine, they wake up, and for the first week or so, they're a little bit, you know, quote-unquote goofy. They're mm-hmm. a little bit, they can't quite concentrate. Mm-hmm. They can't quite multitask. You know, like reading and everything, they get very restless. Mm-hmm. And that, we think, is because all the blood goes out of the body, goes into a machine, and comes back. Mm-hmm. And there must be something that happens when it sees a different surface mm-hmm. that elicits what we call mild neurological dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is it's...
These things don't happen if you do a beating heart surgery.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So the other problem with the pump is things like it affects the lungs a little bit. And it, for mm-hmm. normal people, it's not a problem. But if somebody has lung disease, it can be a problem, or kidney disease can be a problem. So by avoiding the heart-lung machine, you avoid all those problems. And it basically becomes just like any other operation, like a gallbladder operation mm-hmm. or a hernia mm-hmm. operation or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But
so
of course...
This obviously must be a very major advance in...
It's an advance. We thought it might be even more of a major advance than it is, but it is a major advance. As I tell my colleagues, it's a difficult operation to do and to learn how to do it. And I say we're probably going to prolong the lives of our patients and decrease our own lives because of the stress. So anyway, the big advantage for a place in India, for instance, is that you take away the cost of the heart-lung machine. So mm-hmm. now all you have to do is get stabilizers. Mm-hmm. And once the heart is stable, and if you can do the bypasses, the cost of doing bypass surgery is almost negligible at this point.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, as long as the physicians have the expertise to do it, bypass surgery can become, you know, a common man type of surgery. And I think that's helped our institution a lot here in Puttaparthi, because a lot of the cost that used to go towards doing bypass surgery can now be diverted to other uses, such as valve surgery, where you have to go on the heart-lung machine and you have to have other expenses. So it's allowed us to do more surgery than we would normally do.
I now want to get to something very special about your career as a doctor and your devotion to Swami. Tell me, have you had any interesting experiences as a doctor while treating patients?
Well, I think I've had some real miraculous experiences.
Exactly, that's what we want to hear.
And I've had some...
I'm glad you came straight to the point. I was sort of, you know, trying to beat about the bush, didn't know how to get it out of you. Now, you're very obliging.
And I've had some experiences where Swami's philosophy and teaching have shaped my way of treating patients as well, mm-hmm. which I guess ultimately may be the true miracle in all this. I think...
When you say shaping your attitude, what exactly do you mean?
About spirituality, about giving yourself up to Swami and to God in general. And I think that's a very important...
So how does that operate in the operation theater?
Well, it affects two things. First of all, how I treat patients mm-hmm. and what I tell patients. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, what you do in the operating room as well. Because you know, and it's very hard to do, and I think I'm still in the journey. Mm-hmm. I've not reached the destination yet. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you think that you are the reason why everything happens, mm-hmm. that's where your head grows, your head swells, you get the ego, mm-hmm. and you get everything. And I think if you give yourself up and you say, whatever you have done is because of Swami, mm-hmm. then it actually alleviates so much of your difficulties and problems. Mm-hmm. And I think I tried to do that in my practice, and I tried to tell my patients about that as well.
In other words, you consciously have tried to give up this doership feeling, as they say.
You know, if you are just, if you consider yourself an instrument of Swami,
exactly.
and not the actual person doing the operation, but you're an instrument of Swami, then all of a sudden you have the confidence to do things that other people won't do.
No, I'm glad you mentioned the word confidence, because Swami says you must have self-confidence. People misunderstand this. You know, self-confidence is what people associate with a man like Mike Tyson. I can go and lick that guy in two rounds or whatever. That's not self-confidence.
It's psi-confidence.
Actually, the word Swami uses is Atma-Vishwasam. Atma is translated as self. So confidence in the self or the Atma, which is God. So self-confidence simply means I'm sure God will make it happen, probably through the instrumentality of this body and mind. So that is the confidence. So look, it looks like that's what you developed and that has helped you. Any particular incident that comes to your mind in this connection?
As I said, I mean, I could do one of the miracles. You know, I think you interviewed Dr. Sivalingam.
That's right.
And he clearly was a miracle, so maybe I won't go over him again.
Yes.
There was another person, and I don't know if I should use his name, but he was a person.
There's no need. Anyway, we won't know.
So he was a Sai Baba devotee, and he had had some problems with his aortic valve.
Mm-hmm.
And they had gone to several people, and they were not comfortable with them. And he had gotten sicker because he was okay for a while. Mm-hmm. And they had come to Puttaparthi, and Swami had said about 4 or 5 years ago, he said, no operation, although the doctors wanted to operate on him right away. And they had, they knew the Malati, who was our president of our SAI organization there in Philadelphia. So they gave me a call and they said, you know, we know you go to Puttaparthi and everything, and would you mind reviewing his case? So I had him come and visit us at temple. And, you know, when I walked into the room, I said, Sai Ram, and I think they were, like, astonished because there was a physician coming and saying Sai Ram to them. And I went over his case, and, you know, clearly he needed to have surgery. They were just very, very reluctant to have surgery. And so I told them that he needed surgery, and I told them that, you know, Swami will take care of them. And so they wanted to come to Puttaparthi to get Swami's blessing. And in the meantime, this gentleman's wife, one of her relatives, I think her mother, had a dream of Swami. And mm-hmm. Swami came to her and he said, you know, this is the time to get him operated. And so they came back to me and they said, you know, we think it's time now because, you know, Swami's came to our dream and he said that. And they said, well, can you do it on a Thursday because that's Swami's day? And it just so happened that that Thursday was the day I was going to be out of town, but I changed my plans and we operated on him. You know, a couple of miraculous things happened during his surgery. You know, they wanted me to take vibhuti that Swami had given me and put it on his tongue and put it on his forehead. And, you know, this is, you know, you have somebody who's going to have surgery. You have about 10 people in the operating room. So imagine taking vibhuti out of somebody's hand and putting it in somebody's mouth. You know, you have so many people who are going to ask questions. So I prayed to Swami. I said, Swami, I'll do this for them. But, you know, please don't have them ask any questions. And you know what? I did it in front of everybody and no one even said one word. You know,
didn't see it.
No, they saw it. And then, you know, I said a little silent prayer to Swami to give me a signal or a sign that everything was going to be okay. And so I go out from the operating room to scrub, and one of our neurosurgeons came to me, and he said, you know, Val, I've been wanting to see you for a long time because one of my friends came over from India, and he gave me this little picture. And I've had it at home for about 3 months. And just today, I had something in the back of my mind said, take it with you.
Mm.
So I took it with me, and I wanted to give it to you. So he gives me a picture, and of course it's a picture of Swami. And in the back, unfortunately I don't have it with me, and I haven't seen the writing in a while, but it had something to say with, if you do good deeds from your heart, you'll be rewarded. And, you know, it's exactly, you know, I'm asking Swami for guidance, and there, I mean, it's direct guidance, not even subtle.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up doing his operation, and everything went, you know, very, very well. And so he woke up the next day, and he said that, you know, although he was under anesthesia, he could see Swami come and take care of him at night. And was paying, you know, paid attention to him, and, you know, he's done very, very well. And so it's one of those, you know, miracles that, you know, people who are devoted to Swami can have, you know, Swami's presence wherever they need to. Another time was, I was operating on this particular patient, had a bad heart attack, and, you know, he needed to have one of his vessels bypassed, but because his heart attack was so bad, we couldn't find the blood vessel.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in a situation where, you know, if you don't find the blood vessel, the chance that he's going to die is very, very high. And, you know, so you, usually what you do is you take a forceps and you try to find the blood vessel. You take a scalpel blade, try to nick the blood vessel. And all of a sudden I heard in my, I could have really, I heard in my head a voice that just said, Sairam, Sairam. And I turned around, and as I turned around, my hand went down and I nicked something, and right there was the blood vessel. And, you know, there, you know, we proceeded to do the surgery, and everything.
Did you think
well.
It was a coincidence?
It was a Sai incident.
Exactly. See, Swami says, coincidence is a miracle where I hide myself.
That's right.
So, if, in case you dismissed it as a coincidence, I was ready with this, but you admitted it's a Sai incident.
You know, everything we do, everything that we do has some significance, and I
yes,
think Swami
true.
Is behind everything. I mean, and, you know, when we were talking about, you know, that, those were like the overt miracles, and others have, many others have happened as well. But in terms of how I treat patients,
mm-hmm.
you know, for instance, I'll tell my patient, and when we start talking, and they'll say, well, am I going to do well, doctor? And I said, you know, I as a physician promise you that I can do the best that I can do, and everything else is up to God. And if you believe in God, you should pray to God, and everything will be fine. And, you know, what I have found, and unfortunately I don't have scientific data, although I can tell you anecdotally, you can take the worst patient, the toughest case, and there are some patients who will just come to me and say, you know, that's right, doctor, I should just pray to God, and I'll pray to God, and everything is in His hands. And if they say that and they truly believe it, they do remarkably, remarkably well. And then you have your other group of people who are the naysayers, I say. You know, they're always looking for, well, what complication can occur? What can do this? What can do that? And you want to tell them, you said, you just have to give yourself up to a higher being, and He'll take care of you. Because if you don't do that, just with all your stress and worry.
At this point, I'm tempted to tell you something which I heard in Bombay. Swami went to Bombay and Delhi in 99 March, and I had the blessing and good fortune to travel with him. In Bombay, he was given a huge public reception in Cooperage, which is a big football stadium. It was packed with people, including in the playing area, over 100,000 people sitting there. And since it was a public reception, the mayor, the sheriff, and all these people spoke, and the governor of the Rotary Club, Dr. Vyas, he's a surgeon, because he came there in a black suit and a bow tie and all that sort of thing. You wouldn't believe he was a surgeon. But he narrated an amazing incident. He said one day two people were brought to his clinic badly injured. There had been an accident in the suburban railway. Both were sitting next to each other. They were of the, more or the same age and physical, you know, stature and all that. And the injuries were more or less identical. They were in pretty bad shape. And one of them kept on saying, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And the other kept on saying, I'm going to live, God is going to save me. He said, the fellow who said God is going to save me lived. The other fellow who said I'm going to die, sure enough, died.
Yeah.
God granted him his wish. And he said, the God who saved him is here, and he went and fell at Swami's feet right in front of the public. It was amazing. So faith in God does play a very important role.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no question about that. Because I think instead of accepting all the responsibility onto oneself, if you can displace that onto somebody else that you can, are devoted to and you trust, I think that relieves a lot of the stress. And of course, you know, with Swami, if you pray to Swami, he will come and
do what's best. Oh, he does that all the time. In fact, once you surrender, even if you don't pray to him, he says, this, his love is recorded. He was about to have a head-on collision with another car, and he didn't even have time to think of Sai Ram. But he was alive. He didn't know how they went past the car. He said, we must have tunneled through it by some magic. And next morning, Swami said, I saved you, even though you didn't call me.
Yeah.
He said, how come, Swami? And Swami said, well, that's because you have surrendered to me. You are under my care. Now, you started by saying that you wanted, like all Americans, to be rich, have two houses, three cars, or whatever, swimming pool in the kitchen, or whatever. And then Swami came into your life and your outlook has changed. How do you feel now? Do you feel you have lost something or have you gained something?
Oh, I don't think I've lost anything at all. I mean, you know, it's funny because ultimately, you know, with Swami's grace, we are in a good position. So we do have all the material things, but we're not focused on getting more material things. Mm-hmm. Our focus is different. And it's, you know, it's the family as well. I think we're more focused on trying to do seva, and realize that, you know, material things are good, but we're not driven by them. When you're a physician in the United States and everything, I mean, you do have material wealth. But it's the concept of running your whole life towards getting the material wealth versus the material wealth kind of being there, but it's more of a sidelight, and your focus is other things. You know, for instance, doing service. And I don't do as much service as I would like to do. But, you know, if a lot of patients come to me without insurance, for instance, or who are troubled, and, you know, one thing that we do is we don't really ask them about their financial well-being, and we operate on them if we can.
Doctor, I must interrupt here to tell you something. People don't understand what service really means. Swami has explained this many times. He says, if you talk kindly to a person, that is service. If you share love with a person, there is service. Service does not mean wearing a badge or a scarf and taking some time off your normal duties, you know. Even this is service. In fact, I believe in wealthy countries, people are hungering for love more than they are hungering for food, because, you know, it's basically an affluent society. Of course, there are the poor. What people lack of are people who would come and talk nicely to them, be kind to them, be loving to them. There's a tremendous hunger for that. And in fact, that takes me on to my next question.
Well, let me answer that question first.
Okay.
Because many times I'll have patients come into my office, and
yes,
I'll be very, very busy.
Yes.
And they'll come and they'll start asking me questions. And, you know, the fastest thing you want to say is just kind of, you know, get it over with. And I have a lot of pictures of Swami. Mm-hmm. So Swami is kind of in there in the room. And every single time I'm about to get impatient, you know, so I'll have a peek at Swami. and I remember exactly what he has said in one of the interviews, is that you have to be patient with your patients.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, immediately I realized, you know, that I should follow Swami's principles. So you slow down, and then you draw pictures, or you can take charts and explain to them. And many patients will say that that's the first time they've actually understood what is their problem. Mm-hmm. And once they understand what their problem is, then they could, in their own mind, start the healing process. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the healing has to do with how you interact with patients. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being loving to patients, I think, is one of the most important things.
You see, that
Swami
is indeed one of the central points about Bhagavad Gita. You do your work consciously and in a loving manner without worrying about the rewards. That itself is service. If the world does this, half the problems in the world would disappear. So it is not necessary, as Swami says, for you to pick up a broom and sweep the villages. It's not really required. Do what you are supposed to do in the station to which you are born. But do it as a service to God and a service to humanity with love in your heart. Now, since you are from America, permit me to ask a question which I ask almost all people who come from there. It looks to me that America definitely needs Swami. It might be prosperous in a material sense, but I think there is something very sadly missing there. And if America were to understand some of the higher values which it once possessed, but since then seems to have set aside for whatever be the reason, then the world would be a different place, because the world tends to do what America does. What America does today, the world does tomorrow. So the question is, how do you think mainstream America can discover Swami?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, you had originally asked me, do you think it's ready for Swami? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's very interesting because America sometimes doesn't get the credit it deserves because it is a pretty open society. And, you know, I think that if you look at the literature, you know, the lay literature, mm-hmm. there is certainly a swing towards spirituality mm-hmm. and the healing powers of prayer. I mean, all these things are titles that come off from Newsweek and Time magazine. And there's been this real trend towards, you know, finding your inner self, all the things that, you know, Deepak Chopra talks about. Deepak Chopra basically talks about everything Swami talks about. You know? And I think so. If there was some push for somebody like Swami, I think they would be more willing to accept it. And for instance, a lot of our bhajan centers, they're all full of Americans. There are a lot of American devotees of Swami. And I think that they are very flexible and willing to listen to something.
There's a very important point here. America is packed with people who are very, very intelligent. But as Gandhi says, he is no God who merely satisfies the intellect. God to be God must rule the heart and transform the senses. So unless America decides to step out of the head and discover Swami with the heart, it's going to miss Swami. So many of the people whom you talk about are well-meaning, no doubt, but I think their approach to these things tend to be intellectual. Mm. Whereas with Swami, that's the first thing that happens. You know, the intellectuals come and they realize that it's no damn use. You've got to throw it away. I'm an example of that. I'm supposed to be a scientist, and I realize that this is not the way. It's the heart. It's the compassion. It's the love. And everybody wants love. So I have a feeling Swami must be seen as the embodiment of love, embodiment of compassion, embodiment of forbearance. And that is the value that we must discover in Swami. So my question is, do you think we in the Sai family can make the people of America, the mainstream Americans, that is, aware of these aspects? For example, you know, even in India, not many people know that there is a hospital like this and all these sorts of things are going on.
Now, I must admit, you know, when I come to India, there's more criticism of Swami than, you know, I mean, obviously there's a lot of praise, but in the lay literature, there's often criticism of Swami. And in the United States, you know, I think maybe there needs to be one event that happens that changes people's mentalities, or if it's a very, very slow process that's ongoing. But I think in the U.S., in terms of the intellect, they're understanding spirituality more. And I think, you know, when you start talking about love in the United States, the first thing you think about is the hippie generation. Mm. So, you know, so they don't understand that concept quite yet, but I think they will understand that concept. I think they're coming towards it. It's going to take a while. But I think, I suspect that populace will be easier to understand about Swami's principles than most other countries. I don't know exactly how we can foster that. We do that in our little ways. I mean, when we have our Sai centers, we do seva, and always people ask us, oh, you know, what group do you belong to? Mm-hmm. And we tell them, and they say, oh, you know, what religion? And we say, we're all religions. And so we spread our, you know, spread the Swami's values a little bit at a time.
That's the point. You see, we rise above religion. There is no question of religion or anything like that. There's only one caste, the caste of humanity, and there's only one religion, religion of love. And the sooner we understand that, the better it is for all of us.
Yeah, unfortunately, religion is a mechanism by people, one of the main reasons people fight, you know. And they should just get away from that concept. You know, if you look at all the religions, they basically, the tenements are all the same. The origination is also very, very close together. So they just have different interpretations, and people use those interpretations to fight with.
Yeah, I think these people who don't know what religion is are the ones who invent all these interpretations. Otherwise, they get out of that. They lose their importance. So would you say that you're quite optimistic that things would look up in America and more of that country would discover the glory of Swami?
I think, overall, I think there's a forward-looking trend. I think it's going to take time. It's nothing that's going to happen overnight.
No, that's true, because as Swami says, everything must be done at the right time, under the right circumstances. Just as people come to him only when their situation is ripe, nations also will come to him only when the conditions are right. You see, if you look at the way people have been coming to Swami from 1940 onwards, 63 years have passed, the type of people who have been coming to him have gradually changed. It is only in the 70s that he started bringing in people who were capable of some organizational work. Till that time, there was hardly any organizational activity, serious organizational activity. Organization, even with respect to Mandir, you know, there were people needed to run the canteen, there were people who needed to run this facility, that facility, a small general hospital, a handful of doctors to look after that. And slowly, you started seeing people come here with different backgrounds. In the 80s, a lot of people with educational background came here. They were needed because Swami had started a university.
Mm.
And then in the 90s, we started seeing a lot of doctors. And then, you know, now you see all kinds of people, judges, lawyers, military brass, some of them with uniforms, some of them without uniform, all sorts of people, tycoons. So there is a role for them to play. It's like in a drama, you know.
Yeah.
It's only when the time is right that the appropriate character comes on the stage. And it's very fascinating. I mean, you see a lot of sportsmen. In 1980s, not a single sportsman showed up here. But in 1995, we actually had a cricket match, a one-day international here in the Hillview Stadium with all the big stars, some of whom are playing right now in the World Cup in South Africa. They played right here before Swami. And the Prime Minister of India came to inaugurate that match. Can you imagine that? For everything, there is a time and a place. I mean, we had the First Lady of Kazakhstan. That's a Muslim country, by the way. She came by a direct flight from Almaty, now called Almaty, to Puttaparthi. And for those days, Puttaparthi was declared a port of entry. They had customs and immigration here. Just for her. She chartered a plane and came all the way here. The King of Nepal came here. And like that, so many people have been coming here. And whoever knew that a man like Dr. Samara would come and then give us this radio facility, using which we broadcast 24 hours a day to whole of Asia, and pretty soon we'll be doing that to Africa and Europe as well. So amazing things happen. In fact, talking about radio, 15 days before we went on the air, I had the foggiest idea there would be A, a radio station, and B, I would be involved in running it. And yet here I am doing that. So fantastic things happen, and they'll keep happening all the time. That's the beauty of God. Well, thank you for being with us. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I'm sure our listeners too would have enjoyed listening to you. And we do hope you'll come again and again and again, not only to the hospital, but also us.
Okay.
Don't forget us. If you have had a very busy day, we will forgive you. But if you have not had a very busy day, do come and tell us about the interesting things happening with you in the hospitals there as well as here. Thank you for the time being. And we look forward to your visit again.
Thank you, Sairam.
You have been listening to an interview with Dr. Valluvan Jeevanandam, cardiac specialist from America. In conversation with him was Professor G. Venkatraman. This program came to you from the studios of Radio Sun.